Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk again about the Kingdom of God, and we're going to specifically talk about education. Schools as Tools was a pamphlet that I wrote a number of years ago, and I've revisited it, rewrote it. A lot of new information has been coming out. Most people don't know the old information, don't know how we got to the condition of depending upon public education for the vast majority of the education in America, because it did not used to be that way. At the turn of the 1900s, the first part of the 1900s, most people were not educated in public schools. It doesn't mean that they were not educated. They simply were not educated in public educational facilities. People were very educated. And even when public schools began to get more and more of the people to attend public education, a lot of the public education was still highly controlled by local families. One-room schoolhouses. My father went to a one-room schoolhouse in the early 1900s. And from his class alone, or within a couple of years of his class that particular year when they were attending school, they produced a couple of admirals, a general, a vice president of the United States. It produced quite a lot of people who were great achievers in our society. Because of the nature of the one-room schoolhouse, as opposed to the institutionalized schools that we now see and have seen now for almost a century in America, they are making changes. And we should not assume that those changes are always for the better. The pamphlet starts giving us a little bit about history, but it approaches from the point of view of Common Core. And we won't go into all the pros and cons of Common Core. People are suddenly worried about Common Core dumbing down their children with a new experimental education, when the entire modern educational system has been an experiment of failure, and they, as long with their children, are already dumbed down quite a bit. The discovery of 1912, eighth grade examination in Bullitt County, Kentucky, that few modern eighth grade students could pass, should have sent shock waves of change throughout the schools of America. But no one seems to know what to do, nor are they willing to do it. Like sheep, they bleat their complaints and wait for others to fix the problem. And that's pretty much the approach in many of the areas of society where we see a problem developing. People like to complain. They like to complain about the economy, the morality of America, the breakdown of the family, but nobody seems to know what is the root cause, the choice that society has made that is bringing about these changes, these undesirable changes. I raised sheep in the high deserts of Oregon. I have been pointing the way for sheep for many years because sheep make mistakes. They make errors in judgment because they're only sheep. And they don't always see what the shepherd sees. He can see the winter coming. He knows they should not graze the hay field. They'll need that hay to get through the winter. He knows that they should not go in certain areas where there are predators. He knows that they need to stick together. And when I first started raising sheep, we had a particular breed that was not very good at sticking together. And it was a lot of work for me as a shepherd to keep them together. But eventually, we changed the breed. And those that we kept for a long period of time, learned that there are predators out there. There are dangerous areas out there. I one time had a sheep fall into the river, full-wooled sheep fall into the river. Well, when their wool soaks up that water, they weigh about 300-400 pounds. You're not going to just pick them up. They already weigh 180 or so when they're dry. But when they're full of water, they can't even stand up. They're so heavy with that water until that water drains out. So I ended up, it was a steep bank, and I could get him to the edge or get her to the edge of the river, but I couldn't get her to over the edge. She couldn't climb up, and I had to just kind of hold her there against the side until she kind of dripped out some of that water, and then I rolled her up, and she still couldn't stand for a few minutes until that water came out of her wool. It won't be that easy for America and for the world today. We have been soaking up a lot of ideas that are going to absolutely be devastating to our society, and you can't just wait a few minutes and it go back to the way it was. When Americans first came here, they weren't Americans, they were Europeans, and they had a different view of things, and even though it was a hard life in Europe, they had to learn something new in America. The wilderness and the harshness of the climate and the harshness of that wilderness and a lot of other things caused us to learn to work together as a society in a voluntary way, take care of the needy of our society in a voluntary way. They tried kind of a socialist approach, thinking that that would be better because they knew that they faced real challenges here in the wilderness, and it didn't work. They starved every year until they decided to take care of, what they produced was theirs. And there's nothing that we produce more important than our children. Yet we farm the education of our children out to other people. Like I said, when public schools first started getting large inroads into the American system of education, the people who were controlling who the teachers were, what they were teaching, etc., were usually a few families that sent their kids to that school. Schools were small. Schools were intimate. You knew everybody. You knew their parents. You knew their grandparents because they were community-based. But today, schools are hundreds and thousands of kids going to the school. Curriculum is decided thousands of miles away. Teachers are educated in, literally brainwashed to some degrees, in the curriculum. Now, of course, they have these degrees and the diplomas, and they spent large amounts of money in order to get them. So now if you bring what they have learned into question, they will, of course, deny. They will even fight you and say, no, I've got this diploma, I've got this education, I've been told I have a degree of knowledge. And there's no going back from that. We taught our six children from the very beginning. The first one was, 6 or 7 years old, and we were to put him on a bus, and he was to drive on that bus for 40 miles to another town and attend classes. And we thought, well, we can teach him first grade. That's not that hard. He doesn't have to go in. And we heard about this homeschooling, and we started the idea of homeschooling our children. We incorporated a small school. We had a couple other families that were interested in homeschooling. We started doing it. And very shortly, I sometimes work in that town. I would come across the kids and curious about what they're learning, and found that my kids were way ahead of the public school kids. And it wasn't that hard. So we tried second grade and third grade, and more kids came along, and they began to study. And some of the kids, it was very easy to teach them, and some of the kids, it was very hard. There were a few homeschoolers nearby, so they had kids to play with. And the whole myth of children that are homeschooled are going to be somehow socially retarded quickly melted away. In fact, kids who go to single-age education in large public schools or even small public schools where they are put together with only their age group, which is an unnatural social structure. They are socially retarded. They find it difficult often to communicate with elderly strangers, with people in, you know, adults in other businesses. They shun small children. You know, like, you don't want to be messing with those little kids because they have their single age group. And this is very subtle how this works in. But I noticed that my kids could go down and they could play with the little kids and they could play with the older kids and they could sit with the older men and listen to them, and they found it interesting. And they were everything but socially retarded. Now some of my kids are shyer than others, but you'll find that even in public education. But we saw a detrimental effect happening to the kids, and a lot of times the parents didn't notice it. But years later, when the kids were coming back with completely different ideas than their parents about politics, about morality, about family, and then I had parents who had previously kind of shunned us because we were homeschoolers and we were doing it when it wasn't very popular. Now we're coming and saying, you know, they should have homeschooled their kids because they saw the change. They saw the contrast. They could remember, you know, what they believed when they came out of school. Things are changing. What we discovered that was really very alarming. When I looked at history books and math books, I collected them. Because I didn't know, I wanted the best ones. And so when I'd go to a thrift store or something like that, I would go through the book section and find old school books. And I would, you know, they were like a quarter a piece. And so I'd buy them and I'd take them home and I would look at the math books and I would look at the history books. And what I noticed, reading history books all the way back to the 1800s, is that history was changing in those history books. It's subtle at first, just certain things not included in the book. And you don't notice that so much because you already know those things because you read all these history books. But then all of a sudden you begin to realize they don't say anything about this. And they don't say anything about that. And where I really started noticing it is in the books in the 1960s, 1980s, 1990s, that they actually totally misinterpreted things in history. But one of the stories that I've told many times is that I had given my son a book on George Washington, and he was only 8, so it wasn't a very complex book, and he read it. And then I asked him, quizzed him in the evening when I got back from work, what'd you learn? Well, what'd you know about George Washington? Well, he had wooden teeth. He's married to Martha. He was a president and he had been a general. Other than that, he really didn't know much about George Washington, the man. So I thought it would be good to find out, did George ever write anything? I mean, he had to have written letters and things like that. And if we read what he actually wrote, we might get a better insight into the man himself. And I discovered I didn't know George Washington. The facts about a person's life are not always telling you who that individual was. And by going back and reading what he actually wrote to people and what people wrote to him and conversations he had at the time, we not only got a better perspective on George Washington and some of the people that he conversed with and got along with and didn't get along with, but we also got a different view of history. And I began to realize that I had been dumbed down. I had not been taught certain things. And now, continuing, that's when I started getting back into history books of the 1800s. Loved to read actual firsthand accounts by people who were living at the time. Because whenever any academic starts to write about history, he cannot help but add his own personal prejudices and views. Now, there were historians back in the 1800s and early 1900s, Charles and Mary Beard, who actually people have written bad things about, but they're actually very good historians. But when you start seeing who is writing the history books later, you begin to realize that some people had an agenda. They were going to leave out some things. And they did this, you know, decade after decade, leaving out a little bit more every decade. Going through World War I and World War II allowed them to make considerable changes. But after a while, you'd left out so much of history and kind of emphasized other parts of history which were not really moving forces in history at all. So much so that you were able to drastically change your commentaries on history because nobody had a frame of reference to question it. And that's when, in the 80s and the 90s, where I was seeing them write about different events and different documents that were produced by government and governments around the world, that I saw that this is just not true. It was like 1984. They're just removing facts from the school books. And then we can talk about math. And I had fifth grade math books in the 1940s that were equal or superior to what they were requiring in eighth grade in the 1980s. I had a fifth grade book that where I just the first problems, word problems, in the first part of the book, first chapter, most of the eighth graders that I shared those problems with could not solve those problems. And these were basic problems, you know, like figuring how much cement you need to pour a sidewalk. In fifth grade, they would know that. Day one, they were answering problems like that. But that was another thing. The making math relative to day-to-day events. I just talked to somebody today about how to calculate the structural strength of a beam for construction for a house, you know, so that it could take snow loads. And there are formulas that you plug in. You say, well, I don't know how to do that. Well, I was a contractor and I needed to know that. Most contractors don't know that. They pay some architect, you know, $1,000 to say what size beam. And I was doing an addition on a building. I guess he got a building permit, but we didn't have, you know, an accurate drawing that covered all the details of, like, what size beam. And the owner who had gotten the permit wanted to calculate the beam, you know, like a 8x8 beam. I said, no, that beam would have to be 16 inches by 8 inches. And he thought, oh, that's going to be terribly expensive. I said, yeah, but it has to be minimum of that. And he wanted to argue, well, don't you think this would be enough? Well, yeah, we're building a shed out back, but not where we were putting this beam and not taking the span. So when the building inspector came by, and this was an old-time building inspector. This is an older guy. He'd been a contractor also for years, and now has become a building inspector. I said, what is the size of the beam that we need for this span, this building, holding up, you know, these trusses? He went and he calculated it out. We have books where you just look it in and you look, you know, here's the chart and here's what it has to weigh and here's the snow load. And you just, it's pretty simple. You don't actually have to have a slide rule. We used to do it with a slide rule, but now, you know, we have these charts. And he calculated it up, and I had hit it right on the money. And, of course, I calculated it up, you know, based on the strength of the wood that we would be using, and I knew the length of the trusses. So the point is, most of your contractors can't figure that out today. Most people can't figure that out today. It was common knowledge to be able to figure that out if you were skilled at all in carpentry. I found books for people who wanted to become carpenters, you know, construction people, in the eighth grade, they had actual school books that would start taking them through all that math that they would need to know in order to figure out trusses and and figuring angles for roofs and valleys. Kids graduating from high school, not eighth grade, high school today, can't figure these things out. They don't know how to do them. Yet, we're supposed to be better educated. We're supposed to be more knowledgeable. The human brain really hasn't gotten any bigger. As a matter of fact, they know lots of stuff, but it's not the stuff that makes them independent. It's the stuff that makes them dependent. It's like navigating. Everybody used to know how to use a sextant and figure out how to navigate. Now they look at their GPS. If somebody pulls the battery, they're lost at sea. But anyway, but there was a decided dumbing down of mathematics and a distortion of history very clearly by the books that we were reading and that I was examining. And we needed to know more. We needed to learn more. And we were actually being taught less. And I actually even seen where there were situations where kids were learning less, but scoring higher. Well, that's easy. You just change, you know, you can pad a test with easy questions, obvious questions. You should read the test. You go back and read that test. You can probably look Bullitt, Bullitt, County, Kentucky, 8th grade, 1912. Google that. See if you can answer those questions. Because I'll bet you your high school students are not going to be answering those questions today. I had a quote in there when I'm talking about deliberate lies, deliberate misconceptions and misrepresentations of history. The trouble with people isn't their ignorance. It's the number of things they know that just ain't so. That was Mark Twain. He actually didn't say that originally. It was actually attributed to a plumber in New Jersey at one time, a long time before Mark Twain. And Mark Twain gets the credit because he was one of the more famous people who said it. But the more I began to read these actual histories, the more I began to realize that somebody was changing history. I could see it. I didn't know anything about any other investigations of this. I wasn't reading what people had to say bad about the public school education. Remember, we just started homeschooling instead of going to public school because of the great distance and the time they would sit on the bus, and we thought that we could teach them. And we'd heard that it was possible. We had no intention of taking the kids all the way through high school. But today, that is actually very possible. And there's lots of reasons why one should do it. Claude G. Bowers said in the U.S. and the Spanish Civil Wars, there's a quote where he says, "History is the torch that is meant to illuminate the past, to guard us against the repetition of our mistakes of other days. We cannot join in the rewriting of history to make it conform to our comfort and convenience." Yet that appears to be exactly what's happened. To control the people, it is essential to keep them ignorant, and especially of history. The best way to keep people ignorant is to give them a degree of knowledge, as if it were the whole truth. Pile upon their minds the thoughts of mass education, but leave out those aspects of reality that would give them a grasp of the whole truth. That would be a plan. Could that be done? It would seem to be almost an insurmountable task. But that's exactly what's happened. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to believe it, because I'm sure you were all taught only the truth in school. I mean, it was written in a book, and the books were written by scholars, and nobody else was tampering with it. Were they, or were they? What if I showed you that they were? Would you believe it? What if I showed you a government investigation of somebody who was doing this with full intent? Would you believe it then? Well, we'll see. James Orwell wrote in his book 1984, to tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then when it becomes necessary again to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed, systematically undermines the solidarity of the family. And that's exactly what is happening. The idea that public education is essential, the idea that public education is good and vital and necessary for the progression of society is actually a strong delusion. It's not. It is absolutely the reverse. You can find lists of people that were homeschooled, and you would not believe the talent that has come out of people that were homeschooled, and not always homeschooled by highly educated people. I'm not saying that all homeschoolers are well taught. They are not. But then again, I'm not saying that everything that's in the public educational system is a lie. But if there's an agenda to the lying, where is it taking us? And where has it taken us since we've been doing it now for a century? Could our schools have been scientifically designed to prevent overeducation from happening? Would we notice the changes? And ignorant people are easily betrayed, and a wicked people can never be ruled by the mild influence of their own laws. And of course, I'm quoting other people in this, but why am I talking about ignorant people are easily betrayed and wicked people can never be ruled by the mild influence of their own laws? Morpheus says in the movie Matrix, "The Matrix is everywhere. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. And ye shall know the truth, and the new truth shall set you free," is from John 8:32. So, shall we know the truth? One of the hardest things about telling somebody the truth, if they already have preconceived notions, is that they have to be willing to accept what they've already been taught and accept it as true. Sometimes from very nice people, it's not true. It's not true at all. And you add one lie after another. Little lies. Before you know it, you have no concept whatsoever of what the truth really is. You don't know where to begin. And so, where do you begin? Back at the beginning. You have to go back and take a look at the whole idea of public education. People may accept a lie, but to deceive the whole world is something the Christian community has been forewarned of and should be forearmed. But are Christians really Christians? Have they been lied to? Have they been deceived? What is the truth? Pilate asked that. We need to ask that all the time. Deception can still take place as it did in the time of Jesus. Preached and walked the earth. The Pharisees had been deceived. They had a vision of what the Messiah was going to be like. They had a vision of what Moses was teaching. But according to Christ, they didn't even know Moses. Because if they had known Moses, they would know him. So that means that what Jesus was preaching was in accordance with what Moses was preaching. Well, Moses said, "Thou shalt not covet." Moses said, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Jesus said these things. Paul says these things. Paul says, "Thou shalt not covet." When men first began to publish Bibles in large numbers and the common man began to read and study their religious history, there was a reaction to this newly acquired knowledge. The people were not as easily controlled when they could begin to think for themselves on the subject matter of the Bible, which the Bible mostly talks about government. It mentions religion only 5 times. But let's take a break, and we'll come back to Keys of the Kingdom, and we'll take a look at some of this. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. As men begin to take a look at history, they begin to read not just the Bible, but other books. And men researched the history, and they told them, how did we get to this point in time? And they could look back, and they could see, you know, like today, you can take pictures of your kids when they're 1 year old, and 2 years old, and 5 years old, and 10 years old. And you can put them in a scrapbook, and you can go back, and it helps you remember. Oh, yeah, I remember we went here. And, oh, I remember. But in the old days, you didn't have that. You had maybe a thing that you picked up somewhere here or a keepsake to help you remember a particular event. Now we can catch them on film. Well, books are a picture of the past. Letters that were written in the past are a picture of what went on before. Now you take those letters and you read them and you get a picture of the past. But if you can't read, then what do you have? You have stories around the campfire passed down from the elderly. But now they could write down these stories. They could read stories written 200 years before they were born, 1,000 years before they're born. They can start to see a whole perspective of history. And you need to control that if you want to control the people, because they will learn from that history. If they see, what was Christ really doing? What was really going on in Rome at the time Christ showed up? What did the Pharisees have wrong? What were they doing that was so much different than Moses? I mean, they prided themselves on the Torah and following every little last jot and tittle. Yet they had missed the whole thing. They didn't even know who Moses was, yet they were reading that book. Words are babble. And you have to really come to your study with a diligent heart to understand what was going on at that time. What was going on in America when the pilgrims came, when they came to Jamestown, and when all those other people came. I was surprised when I read about the Sparrow, which was one of the early boats that came to America, and they actually have the boat or parts of it, what's left of it, in a museum. And you're thinking, like, those guys came across the Atlantic Ocean in that boat? I mean, it isn't the Mayflower. It's like an open rowboat. And they came all the way across the ocean and landed on the shore and started, you know, hunting and fishing and making a settlement. They didn't do very well, most of them. But what was going through their minds? What were they learning? What was their day-to-day lessons? You don't learn that in history. History today, most of what you read in history today, is reading dates where governments exercised authority over people. Or people threw off governments and created a new government. But the history of the people is what they were doing every day. There's a fellow who wrote about the Bible times. He wrote a number of books. Some of them are quite different, but Shalom Ash wrote a few books. And he gives you a very close perspective of what the people were actually doing day to day, what life was like in some of the books that he wrote. There was a history book from, and it says history from 1492 to 1892. And it's a big, thick book, like a giant Webster's dictionary. And I know somebody who owns that book, and I really thought that book was great when I was reading. He loaned it to me for a little while, and I'm reading, and he's telling you the events of these people's lives right out of their diaries, you know, with no elaboration. No saying, he's this kind of guy. You're seeing what they're writing, what they're doing, and their adventures. And you get a wholly different perspective than what I got when I studied history through somebody else's interpretation. Now, I didn't study I never read history books that were written before 1900s until I took the point to do so. And I got a much different view of history and what the conflicts were, what the American Revolution was really all about, who was really revolting. Because actually, it was the king who was revolting. They were talking about rights that the king was usurping. What rights was he usurping in America? Why were they having statements in the parliament by prestigious individuals in parliament, famous men in parliament, saying that the king could pass these laws anywhere in the kingdom, in the British kingdom, but not in America? Why couldn't he do it in America? What was different in America? Why couldn't he pass those laws in America? Most people have no idea. What history had brought them to the point where British people in, you know, England, in Parliament, were arguing for America, saying, you can't pass these laws in America because something's different in America. You won't even find that in the history books today. What was different? So anyway, when they began to print that Bible, and along with a lot of other history books, it was soon realized, you know, the first people who printed the Bibles, some of them were tried and even executed for printing the Bible. They didn't know how they were doing it. They were producing so many of them. I mean, when Tyndale started translating the Bible, he had to flee the country. Originally, he had a contract to translate the Bible from the king. And then suddenly, when they started doing this, they said, oh, we can't do that anymore. We can't have this translated because it's saying things like the perfect law of liberty and stuff. And people were starting to put things together. And so he had to flee. And eventually they caught up with him and got another government to cut out his tongue and burn him at the stake. But before that, he had translated the Bible, and his first translations were printed, and he was starting to sell them, and they ran out and they bought up all his Bibles and burned them so that nobody would get them. But he, of course, that gave him the money to make some more and to continue his work. So eventually they had to not just burn his books, they had to get a hold of him and burn him, which they did. And then, of course, they got their own guys to translate the Bible. And they were scholars, and they had to be careful, but they even wrote, you know, this is the best job we could do under the circumstances. What circumstances were those? Well, they were working for the guy, the public office, the king. Not the same king, who's a different king now, but for the same office that had burned Tyndale at the stake, although he had him burned by another government across the waters there. The reality is that if you can't stop knowledge, the plan was to twist knowledge, to alter the way that people see what they're reading. And the way you do that, and we have another book coming up on how the definition of words have changed. And when you're translating, you have a great opportunity for changing the meaning of words. And of course, that's exactly what they've done with history. They've changed the meaning of words, they've deleted facts, they've deleted pieces of the puzzle, and they reconstructed the puzzle in another image, and they say, this is history. And it's not. It's not history. Jesus said unto them, if ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now you say, we see, therefore your sin remains. And that's what some men did. They knew the truth, and they distorted it with a planned agenda. Not just in the 1900s, 1908, in America, which we'll get to in subsequent shows, but they actually began way back. They did it back in the days of Jesus Christ. They did it back in the days of the Septuagint. They did it in the early church in Europe. And they did it in the 1000s. They did it in the 1500s. They always do it. Sophistry is a key tool of tyrants, from Satan to Nimrod to whoever. They have to change the meaning of words. The most controversial issue of the 21st century will pertain to the ends and means of modifying human behavior, and who shall determine them. The first educational question will not be what knowledge is of the most worth, but that question will be, what kinds of human beings do we wish to produce? The possibilities virtually defy our imagination. Now, that's Professor John Gottlieb, who is a researcher and chief mover in American education during the last half of the 20th century. They knew what they were doing. They wanted to mold humanity, change the way in which people think, change the way in which people react, change the way in which people make decisions, and change those decisions to suit themselves. And in order to do this, they had to change the truth about history. They had to change the truth into a lie. And they set about doing that. Now, some of this conspiracy that we're talking about is a conspiracy of the heart. Because the heart often tells us what facts are important and what facts are not important. What it sets the agenda of the information coming in. It filters out the validity of the information. You get 500 facts in studying history, and you delete 100 of them as unimportant, and somebody else deletes a different 100 that he thinks unimportant, you're going to have two completely different views of history. If you emphasize other facts and pieces of information, you're going to have another version of history. You need to be like Patrick Henry, who was willing to know the whole truth and provide for it. Because that's really the key. The truth shall set you free, but not parts of the truth. It's the whole truth that will set you free. Nothing less. We want the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help me God. So humility is the key. The truth is, we are slaves to our own pride, which keeps us from seeing that we do not already know the truth. No one can be told what the truth is unless they are willing to believe that they do not already know the truth. So you have to have an open mind, and you have to take a look at the facts and look at the pieces of the puzzle. I was discovering this conspiracy theory when I had no information about conspiracies. I have done this with a lot of things throughout my life. I won't go into them now. This is probably not the show to talk about. But there are certain decisions I made when I was 9 years old based on observations of people in acting and interacting amongst themselves. And then decades later, somebody came up and had come to the same conclusion about the particular things that I was observing, but based on facts and information that have been kept from him in history. Personally, I think the better choice is the personal observations when you look into the eyes of people and you see that this practice is bad. This is not a good way to go. It's kind of like math problems. I solve a lot of math problems different than other people solve them. I can't always remember the formulas, but I understand the basics enough that I can create the formulas every time I need to solve the problem. Now, if I do it on a regular basis, I can remember it. But sometimes, you know, you go a long ways away from knowing how to calculate lines in navigation, and then you get rusty on it. And other people will look up on charts today, you know, to find their secants and cosecants. But you can actually work your way back to that using math, but it takes a lot longer. It's kind of like what we call reconstructing the wheel. And so, but knowing those principles of math is what is essential to really understanding math. Knowing the principles of mankind, how he acts, reacts, the motivations. Because the motivations in life today are the same motivations of life back in the 1700s. But we have lots of other things piled upon those internal natural motivations so that we don't have a clear view, and we can actually run towards that which is a bad idea. We can defend a bad plan because it seems familiar. It's what we've learned. It's what we've been taught. And we have never even heard otherwise. Really, what a free society is, most governments throughout history have been voluntary governments based on networks of people who come together because of those common natural interests and motivations. And they come together because they know, because of the circumstances of their environment, if they don't come together, they will be destroyed. And so they come together, and they do this with famines, with invasions, with disease, with any kind of calamity, even minor or catastrophic. And they are dependent upon that network and those relationships. Israel was like that. Abraham was like that. The early church was like that. The Teutons were like that. Many Indian tribes were like that. And it made them stronger with those bonds of society that were naturally cultivated by the circumstances of a hard life. You know, the Eskimos, how they survived in such a harsh climate will give you insight. It's the anthropology of natural man. Well, we get away from that, and we think the solution is somewhere else. If you don't understand the history, and you cannot understand the history unless you understand men and their natural motivation, men and women and our natural needs and inclination, which is really telling you how to govern yourself in a free society. That's what the Bible is really about, how to govern yourself in a free society. And it requires virtue. And it requires that you love one another, that you care about one another's rights. You attend to the weightier matters that Christ lists off in the gospel. And you all know them because you all have read about Christ, right? But actually, almost nobody knows what that list consists of. Because they read the Bible. I've known people read the Bible and they don't know that list. They study Christ. They think they know Christ, but they cannot list off what Jesus calls the weightier matters. Unbelievable. But that's exactly where we're at with history. We miss it. It's deleted from our study plan. And so but when we pass our tests, when a teacher gives a test, you know, I've studied subjects, but I also learned the reason I could get good grades is I studied the teacher. When I take notes in his class, I can tell by his inflection, this is important. He's going to ask me this later. And I'll write it in my notes. I did that for 1 year. And my notes looked, you know, I only had a few pages of notes in that class because this was it's one of those teachers who do a lot of BSing. And at the end of the year, when I looked at my notes getting ready for the final exam, I only had a couple pages. Those notes look like the final exam. And when I put in the answer, I could put in his answer. Then I would put my answer underneath. And I says, this is what your answer is. This is what my answer. I did that on several of the questions. I think it drove them crazy. But anyway, the point is, we really have to go back and take another look at education, the whole idea of education. And I'll leave you with this thought. Public school is based on the idea that you tax everybody in the community. You make everybody, whether they have children or not, whether they're going to stay in the community or not, whether they're here just for a few years or they're going to be here for 20 years, you tax them. You force them to contribute money to the government, and the government builds a school. If they don't pay the tax, you take their home away from them, and you sell it to somebody who will pay the tax. That's the structure, and we've accepted that, and we've come to believe that that's the case, you know, because Jesus said something about pay Caesar what you owe Caesar. But the reality is, it's not that simple. Why do you owe? Why can the government take your house away from you if you don't give them a few thousand dollars for public school? They can take your $100,000 home away from you and sell it to somebody else and give you nothing. It's because you don't really own your home. That's not what American history was all about. Americans came here to actually own their land, untaxable, so that nobody could take their home away. Their home was their castle. They were kings and priests in their home. They had to pay the duties and excise taxes, but there was no excise tax on their land. This is what the American Revolution was really fought over, probably more than anything else. But you wouldn't know that. And today, you are slaves in your own country. Well, there was another article I wrote it touches on some of the money issues and some of the problems with the money issues. And I thought this would be a good time to quote Thomas Jefferson, who said, central banking is an institution of the most deadly hostility existing against the principles and form of our Constitution. I am an enemy to all banks discounting bills or notes for anything but coin. If the American people allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless on a continent their fathers conquered. That's where we're at today. That's where we've gone. That's where we have gotten to. And there's a lot of different reasons why, and you probably don't understand them unless you go back and begin your education again. But anyway, we're going to have a couple more parts to this series on homeschooling, and we're going to reveal to you some information a lot of people are unaware of. But really, the most important thing is that you start coming together in faith, hope, and charity, loving your neighbor as yourselves. And one of the ways to do that is join the Living Network at thelivingnetwork.org and start gathering with other people who are willing to look at the whole truth and provide for it. So until then, may peace be upon your house and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.